Well, May, we're continuing on now. I see that you brought a lot of documents to back up the things that you've been telling us. Many people have talked to me, and I've talked to a number of people on the phone that have called in about the programs. And I had an interesting call last week. A man said it's the first time he had heard the program, and that he was very much impressed by what you had said. He was not fully convinced that you were right, but he was not convinced. And that was encouraging, because at least he was listening with an open mind, and I think these are the people we're trying to reach.
That's really
good. With the program.
Yes. The people who, if they can have an open mind and ask questions and write letters and call this station and just don't take up too much of Gloria's time, just call up and say, "This is my phone number. Have Mae Bressel call me." If you embarrass about your name or you think you're going to lose your job, just leave your phone number, and I'll rap with you on the phone about questions you have in your mind. And then after we talk, you can disclose who you are. You don't have to, because
Maybe you could stay tonight.
Yes,
and take some phone calls after the program. I think maybe that might be a good
idea. I'll stay for 3 or 4 or 5 calls. And if you want to call at the end of this hour, you have any question about the material I brought up in the evening, that we clarify, so that, because the next week we get on another subject, I'll pick up those calls. Now, on the second half of the show, I think I'll just jump to some of the documents that are coming out of the National Archives and share them with you, because they're really too good to just sit on my shelf in the filing cabinet or wait till I write a book. And the bulk of my research, again, is the witness testimony in the Warren Report, first 15 volumes, and compared to the documents and exhibits in volume 16 to 26, the last 10 volumes. Those last 10 volumes are State Department papers, affidavits, FBI reports, Secret Service reports, as against what witnesses say. And I saw that there was a discrepancy between the exhibits and the witness testimony, and I began a very complicated cross-filing system, which went into 28,000 pages of research on just one particular area in the assassination, on Lee Harvey Oswald, agent of the United States. Now, a person visiting the Monterey Peninsula heard our program. This was last September, and he was passing through, and he was impressed with the program, and wrote two letters, one to Alan Cranston, the U.S. Senate, and the other was to Senator John Tunney. And he was concerned about the information that I was saying and wanted to know if it could be shared with more people, that if it was true, it was alarming, and what do we do about it? And should these senators take notice of Mae Bressel? The answer that this particular gentleman got back from each of the members of your Senate is the following. John Tunney said, "Dear Mr. Olish, thank you for your letter. I did not hear the broadcast you referred to in which Mae Bressel is being interviewed by a program commentator. I have no idea where she gets her information, unless like the rest of us. She reads the newspaper, listens to the TV and the radio, and has some first-hand information, and I'm curious how she could make some of the connections she does, but I know nothing about her." And he signed his name, John Tunney, best regards. He isn't very curious. I'm making startling statements about candidates being killed and a president being killed, a civil rights leader being killed, and he's assuming that I'm just like the rest of you out there, or the rest of us, he says, where I get this from the radio or TV. To answer John Tunney, we'll read a few documents. But before we do that, I'll read you from Alan Cranston. He said, "Dear Mr. Olish, I appreciate your concern for the allegation that by Mae Bressel that implicated the CIA in the death of President Kennedy. I do not know Ms. Bressel, and I highly doubt that she has any basis to her story whatsoever. Many people have looked for plots in the tragic death of President Kennedy, and I'm afraid that Ms. Bressel is trying to draw public attention to another story that has no basis in fact." Signed, Alan Cranston. So with that, to show you where your senators' heads are at, I will proceed, as time allows, to read you a few documents that have come out of the National Archives that are declassified. The first one is a letter dated January 29th, from David Bellin,
1964.
David Bellin, an attorney for the Warren Commission, to Mr. J. Lee Rankin, that's the general counsel of the commission. Subject, the examination of Marina Oswald. In reviewing the proposed questions for Marina Oswald, Mr. Ball and I have discussed the possibility of whether or not she'd be willing to submit to a polygraph examination in addition to regular interrogation. There are three basic reasons for our suggestion of a polygraph. One, a substantial portion of key testimony by Marina is not subject to ordinary tests of credibility. Two, insofar as the public is concerned, we believe that the submission to a polygraph examination would serve a substantial addition upon our final publication of the report. Three, if under polygraph examination it were to be shown that Marina Oswald had not been truthful in her testimony, it could throw an entirely new light on aspects of the investigation. End quotes. Now, Gloria, all of my research for 8 years has been to throw out the entire Warren report on the basis that Marina Oswald's testimony was the only thing that held it up. There was no evidence of ballistics, capability, ownership, anything at all, that Marina Oswald was the sole person holding up this report. And by their own admission, if she lied, an entirely new light would have to be thrown on the investigation. And I'll send a copy of this to Senator Cranston and Tunney to show them that my ideas come from the commission themselves. I have the documents to show why a new investigation would show altogether different conclusions. But they themselves, Joseph Ball and the attorneys from the Warren Commission, recognize this fact. This is a letter, now I'm going to read, dated February 28, 1964, from Norman Redlich, another attorney in the commission, to the chief counsel, J. Lee Rankin. During the course of yesterday's questioning of James Martin, many questions were asked relating to the character and personal life of Marina Oswald. Oh, I have to end the letter here, Gloria, to explain. James Martin was a member of the Secret Service, not Secret Service, he was a friend of the Secret Service, and right after the assassination, she was taken to the Inn of Six Flags, which is a hotel in Dallas, outside of Dallas, and she then went to the home of James Martin for many weeks. And she lived at this particular home, and she didn't return to the home of Mrs. Payne where she lived before the assassination. And she was housed there and taken care of, and all of her bank account dealings and the people who met her and the large funds of money came through the hands of James Martin, and they thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars were pouring in for Marina Oswald. And James Martin was her host and protector. And James Martin was interviewed by the Warren Commission. Getting back to the letter by Norman Redlich, he says, James Martin stated that he had consciously attempted to create a public image of Marina Oswald as a simple, devoted housewife who suffered at the hands of her husband, and who was now filled with remorse for her husband's actions and deeply grateful for the generosity and understanding of the American people. As Martin's testimony indicates, there is a strong probability that Marina Oswald is, in fact, a very different person. Cold, calculating, avaricious, scornful of generosity, and capable of an extreme lack of sympathy and personal relationship. The commission has undertaken not only to determine who fired the shots that killed President Kennedy, but to study all the evidence which would lead to an explanation of why this crime was committed. If Lee Oswald was the assassin, the character and personality of his wife must be considered relevant in determining the motive. There are many explanations for the assassinations, a foreign or a domestic plot, and Oswald's political motivations. And he said, to the extent that we ignore any possible explanation for the crime, we are focusing the attention of the commission and history on other motives which may not be sound as the one we ignore. This would be a disservice to the cause of truth, which, in your words, is our only client. I'm reading a letter from Norman Redlich to the Warren Commission, dated February 28th. Neither you nor I have any desire to smear the reputation of any individual. We cannot ignore, however, that Marina Oswald has repeatedly lied to the Secret Service, the FBI, and the Commission on matters of vital concern, and to the people of this country and the world. As you know, I was not in favor of placing on the record the story of her actions in Washington, because we already have statements which provide us with all we need to know on this matter, and formal testimony could have added very little. But if a witness who has had a close association with Marina Oswald is prepared to offer certain insights into her character, including those of a derogatory nature, I feel it is the mandate of the commission's inquiry to compel us to consider this testimony and letter.
What happened there?
Well, you know, Gloria, from our first show, what happened. I mentioned that Marina Oswald is one of the most famous women in American history. She'll go down. Infamous is the word. You know how they took that up. They didn't do anything about it.
They didn't do anything, right.
They coddled her. I have letters where they said it's inadvisable to brush her feathers. She's making all this money off the assassination. She made a large amount of money. She got citizenship from Russia. She effected a change in our whole power structure. If that woman can undo things that were being done, maybe another female, maybe Brussels, can get them back again. If a woman can undo it, maybe a woman can get it back. And I meet her head on any time, any place, and so does the Warren Commission staff. Now, here's a letter dated March the 12th, 1964, from Mr. Coleman and Mr. Slauson, attorneys from a well-known firm in Pennsylvania that came down to work for the Warren Commission, and it's to Mr. Jenner, Mr. Lieber of the Warren Commission. This is how the letter reads. In the FBI summary of the report of Special Agent Gumberling, it is indicated that Oswald, on October the 15th, 1963, might have been able to secure a job as a cargo handler at $310 a month. The report states that he did not report to the employer since, according to the notation, he had another job on October the 16th and was working. According to page 220 of the same report, he took a job on October the 16th at the Texas School Book Depository, which paid $208 a month. Standing alone, these two facts indicate that Oswald may have had a non-economic reason for taking the job at the Texas School Depository. Now, it says perhaps Lee Oswald said something at the Payne residence that would shed light on why he didn't want the better job, end quotes. We have mentioned before my research that Lee Harvey Oswald applied for a job as a cargo carrier. It was at Love Airfield, and the commission documents in the last 10 volumes, I call them the exhibits, the documents, show the job applications at the employment office, and it said he was applied on this particular date, October the 15th, for a job as a cargo carrier at Love Airfield, and October the 16th, he was ready for work. It didn't say that he turned it down. It didn't have a negative. It also said that the same date he applied for a job at the Texas School Book Depository, and it also says that he started work there on the 16th. So what I want to say is this, that Lee Harvey Oswald had two jobs, one at Love Airfield and one at Book Depository, and if the motorcade were changed, he could be at one of the other places because very few people at the depository worked with him on the sixth floor and he moved things around. He could have been at either place when John Kennedy came to Texas, and certainly in October they knew he'd be there in November. So the explanation of why Oswald worked for $100 a month less when he'd been floating around in New Orleans and Mexico and back to town and his wife was having a second baby is something the commission should have taken note of. And when the attorneys, Mr. Coleman and Slauson, said it may have been non-economic reasons, you can believe it was, but this is the kind of information the Warren Commission chose to ignore. How he had two jobs, applying the same day, accepted both places, and both places are locations where John Kennedy would be. Now, we've talked about a location, a photographic lab that Lee Harvey Oswald worked at in 1963. It was a CIA building. They do maps for overseas, domestic maps, overseas maps for the military. They print government bonds. The name of the photographic lab is called Jagger's Chili Stovel. I'm going to read you a letter dated April the 7th, 1964, from Edward Conroy and John O'Brien, attorneys for the Warren Commission, to Mr. J. Lee Rankin. Mr. Rankin was the chief counsel, so all the memorandums came to him, and when he had questions, he sent them to J. Edgar Hoover, and I have copies of his correspondence. Now, here's the letter. A review of the actual time record covering Oswald's employment at Jagger's Chili Stovel shows that on numerous dates, Oswald worked on photographic jobs for Sam Bloom. A Sam Loom operates a public relations and advertising business in Dallas, and the Sam Loom agency handled the advance publicity in Dallas in connection with President Kennedy's visit. It would seem that either Mr. Bloom or a member of his staff would have had contact with Jagger's Chili Stovel and possibly Oswald in connection with his photographic work. Although Oswald's employment ended at Jagger's Chili Stovel on April 6, 1963, it is probable that his association with the company may have provided him with an acquaintance in the Sam Bloom agency. In connection with the work Oswald was doing at Jagger's Chili Stovel for the Sam Bloom agency, it is noted that in a period of approximately 10 weeks, Oswald worked on the Sam Bloom assignment on 60 different days. Now, there's much in the Warren Report on the coincidence that Lee Harvey Oswald was in the book depository. See, this is how Mrs. Payne called Roy Truly and said, somebody's living with me and her husband needs a job. And the coincidence that the motorcade slowed down at 10 miles an hour around that curve through the underpass, and that the building was never covered that day. No one was on the roof or the windows or anywhere near the building. The building wasn't closed off for 25 minutes. These are all coincidences that the commission wants you to think about.
You have a whole section in your files on coincidences.
Oh, yeah, the whole thing on coincidences. But here you have the Warren Commission aware of problems. This is in April. They're bringing up the subject of the Sam Bloom agency. Now, I have cross-filed all of these sections and read the 26 volumes, it's supposed to be I don't know how many million words, carefully over and over. And there is no mention of a Sam Bloom in that. So that the information that they pulled in was what they wanted to have. Some of it they didn't mean to have, but some they wanted to have. Now, here's a letter from Mr. Lee J. Rankin, the chief counsel of the Warren Commission, directed to J. Edgar Hoover. The date on this is September the 9th, 1964. That's an interesting date because the Warren Report is going to come out 2 weeks later. Dear Mr. Hoover, why did the FBI chief in Dallas, Gordon Shanklin, state that the paraffin test run on Oswald's face was positive, when the actual laboratory affidavit shows it to be negative on the face and that he could not have fired a rifle? Would you please ascertain whether Mr. Shanklin made any remarks on the subject of the paraffin test? Signed, J. Lee Rankin. Like that one?
Was there any follow-up on that?
Oh, no, the Warren Report came out a week later.
It was already printed by that time.
It was gone to print. You see, since May, they'd been worrying about how they're going to cover up the credibility. But in their own minds, we're talking about the evidence of a murder. See, they said, don't emphasize the information, the facts. Stress the credibility of the commission and the amount of witnesses called, you see. Here's a KBOX television or radio news announcement that came over the air on November the 22nd, 1963 in Dallas. Sam Pate reporting live. Speculation is that three or more men were involved in the shooting. One man with a clenched fist said he was a pro-Castro. Oswald did hold his fist up in that way. But he doesn't admit anything, but he is a prime suspect. Captain Fritz says the man is still a prime suspect. End quotes. There was no other suspect. There's photographs of people being taken off the street. And I showed one on a television show here, but no other suspect. Here is a real WBAP television, November 22nd, 1963, in Dallas. Dr. Malcolm Perry, attendant surgeon at Parkland Hospital, Lieutenant President Kennedy, when he arrived at the emergency room, noticed the president was in critical condition with a wound in the neck and head. When asked to specify, Perry said the entrance wound was in the front of the head, and he might have meant it had gone in one temple and out the other. That was the wound. There's many, many remarks that he was sure that day they were entrance wounds in the head and in the throat. News report, WBAP, November 22nd, 1963. President Kennedy and Governor Connally of Texas and their wives were riding together in the president's convertible. They were leaving downtown Dallas at the time the assassination occurred near a triple culvert, and the shot that was fired at the president was fired from apparently the fifth floor of a warehouse by a 7.65 Mauser. That's a German army rifle. Apparently three shots were fired. One struck the president in the right temple and went cleanly through his head. A White House physician said it was simply a case of a bullet going clear through a man's head. That's the way the news read. But You see, apparently the fifth floor, 7.65 Mauser.
That was the fifth floor. I thought it was the sixth floor.
Well, they did find a Mauser on the fifth floor. You see, this is the point. Later, it became an Italian carcano.
Right.
But when the police chief took it away, and he should know weapons, and they all examined it for 24 hours, it was a Mauser. And many people want to know, how did I get into my assassination inquiry on November 22nd? I read you the bulletins of the news office, the case is closed, no conspiracy,
right.
The German Mauser. These are the things that whetted my appetite. You can see they were all coming over. Now, here's a letter from Mr. Lee J. Rankin of the commission to Mr. J. Edgar Hoover. We talked before about the paraffin tests. This is dated July 23rd, 1964. Dear Mr. Hoover, it has been alleged that the palm print lifted from Oswald's rifle by the Dallas police is false. This allegation is supported by the statement that the FBI told the press in an off-the-record briefing session November 23rd or 4th that there was no palm print on that rifle. Would you notify us at any time if the FBI told you or let it be known to the press that there was no palm print on that rifle? This is what...
You had just stated in the beginning.
Oh, yes.
About the palm print.
Yeah. In August of 1964, a letter went to Mr. J. Edgar Hoover saying, there's a conflict between the testimony of Mr. Latone of the Bureau, this is what we were talking about before, and Lieutenant J.C. Day of the Dallas Police. And we would like to have a statement from Lieutenant Day setting forth specifically and in detail what steps he took in the processing of the weapon for prints, and the description of any instructions he may have received in that connection and from whom he received them.
Was anything more done on this, May?
No, this was in August.
Was
the Warren report came out in September. The ballistics, the rifle ownership, the palm print, the paraffin tests were all negatives, you see. No, nothing. The Warren report was written before the gun went off for all practical purposes. Mr. Rankin wrote to J. Edgar Hoover, we'd like to have the statement of Lieutenant Day as to when and why he turned the weapon over to the FBI and the exact circumstances under which he did it, when he first noticed the palm print, and who, if anyone, he told about it at the time. You see, this print was to come 7 days later in Washington, and nobody knew about it out in Dallas, who he told about at the time. And we'd like to have copies of any written reports he made about that print, as well as the photographs which he may have taken of that print that was on the rifle. Lieutenant Day should be questioned concerning his usual practice in photographing prints and establishing beyond question that a print, in fact, appeared on a particular object from which it was claimed to have been lifted. And if he did not follow his usual practice in the instant case, we'd like to know why he did not. And we'd like to know what precautions he took to protect that print, which he claimed still remained on the rifle when it went to Washington.
But they didn't find any on the rifle when it got to Washington.
No. Now, at the time of the assassination, Gloria, Marguerite Oswald went right away to the public officials. And she said, my son was an agent of the CIA. And, of course, they put her down. But August 21st, 1964, William Coleman, the attorney for one of the attorneys for the Warren Commission, wrote to another higher-up official who was doing work and said, I'm sending my comments on Lee Harvey Oswald's life in Russia, and in the foreign conspiracy section, do you think we ought to deal with the question, one, was Oswald a CIA agent? And two, whether the ease with which he got his second passport raised any inference of conspiracy? And now, this is a letter dated August 21st. Remember that the memos I read at the beginning of the show are telling you how we'll pass off on these open minds the validity of the commission, the credibility of the work, the amount of people called. The Warren Commission itself was filled with doubts all through July, August, September. They hadn't even scratched the surface, and I've been scratching it for 8 years, and I'm ready to go to Washington now and say, look, this is my work. This is what I know. This, by your own admission, is what you haven't even gone into. Why were these men sending the memos? Here's another letter that's interesting. This one is from Bert Griffin of the Warren Commission to Mr. Howard Willens, another attorney, dated August 14th. The dates are important because the report's coming out in September. It says, regarding Jack Ruby's testimony, both the preface and the conclusion of the Warren report that they're writing up now, they're polishing it up, state that the commission found no evidence that anyone assisted Jack Ruby in the shooting of Lee Oswald. Certainly, It is true that there is insufficient evidence to conclude that any particular person assisted Ruby. Nonetheless, we have not conducted an investigation which would effectively exhaust the possibility that someone did assist Ruby, even if that assistance were unwitting. And inasmuch as Ruby is alive and will continue to dicker concerning his fate, I think it is a mistake for the Commission to make any statement which indicates that its investigation in this regard is exhaustive. I would prefer to state the facts that we have uncovered and remain silent on the issue of whether anybody not connected with the assassination of President Kennedy could have assisted Ruby. I do think that our investigation in the question of whether or not there was a tie-in between Ruby and the assassination is adequate to conclude there was no tie-in. Their investigation so far, but to make the further suggestion that no one aided or encouraged Ruby is a risk we should not incur. End quote. Well, we could go for 5 hours. It's a shame to break the continuity because I think some people may forget next week to listen, and other people will pick up next week, and it would be nice sometime to just do a marathon of reading the commission memos to each other and have people jot them down in some way and get it into their head that this is...
I don't think... The last document you read about Ruby, I don't think... It has occurred to people that there might have been help in the death of Lee Harvey Oswald because so many people saw that film of Jack Ruby shooting Lee Harvey Oswald in the police hallway that I think they would just take that as fact.
Yeah, but the important thing in terms of world history of power is who gained by him silencing the past.
Then you have to remember the 9 bullets, the 10 bullets in Bobby Kennedy.
In the ambassador.
In the ambassador, and then the discrepancies in the bullets in President Kennedy.
Oh, yes, it goes on and on, but it's very important to see if you understand what the Warren Commission is writing. The logic is that they said there's insufficient evidence, but he says we haven't even conducted an investigation. And this was in August of 1964. I have spent 8 years on the links of Ruby to the people involved in the assassination. And I can go to Washington now and say, look, this is what had happened. This is the banks they used. This is where they met. And Ruby did not have to know Oswald. But here is the commission just about ready to go to print. And they have nowhere wanted to find the truth. There was no reason for them to close the hearings. And the consensus was, the orders were get it done before the election. Richard Russell, the senator from Georgia, and Senator Cooper did not want to close the commission findings. They felt that even though it was an election year, the truth would be better served. And the other men were overpowering in their influence, and they closed up the Warren Report. It had a date. Everything has a date in this country to affect elections. Why is this timely? Why is the research timely now? Because you have elections in 72 and everything's packaged for your heads, you know, as we roll along. Do we have time for one more letter, Gloria?
Yes.
One more. Now, I will take a few calls when the show is over. Not too many, but I'll take a few if you want to call in and ask a few questions. I'll take one more. Here's a letter from William Coleman and David Slauson to the attorney staff of Mr. Ball, Bellin, Jenner, and Liebler, dated March the 16th. It says, the following statement was made by Nelson Delgado, a former Marine buddy of Oswald's. Delgado advised us, because of the nature of their assignment at Santa Ana, the Marines were required to fire the rifle only once a year. This is what I was talking about. And Oswald and all the others joined in this pool. And Oswald just about did qualify, and it had always been Delgado's opinion that Oswald penciled in his qualifying score. It was Delgado's further opinion that Oswald was not a good shot while he was with the Marines at Santa Ana, California, and he never showed any unusual interest in rifles or guns at all. He was just average in the Marines in terms of shooting. And
well, whoever fired those bullets
did a good job.
Would almost have to be classified a marksman, wouldn't they?
Yes, they'd have to be a pretty good marksman. Here's a letter from Mr. Bellin to Mr. Jenner, dated February the 14th, and it is regards to the home where Marina Oswald lived with Michael and Ruth Payne. Michael Payne was a nuclear physicist, a designer of helicopters that built aerospace with security clearances, third-generation Harvard. His grandfather graduated from Harvard University. He went to Harvard, and Michael Payne was the host of Lee and Marina at his home. He was separated at the time from Ruth Payne, but the day of the assassination, he moved right in. Marina had three friends that she visited at different times, Elena Hall, Ruth Payne, and there was one other that while she was there, the husbands were away, but as soon as Marina left, the husbands came back. Do we have time for this one letter, or are we running short of time?
Yeah, we are running short.
Okay, well, we can do this next week, Gloria.
But you will be here for a few minutes after the show to take any phone calls.
If you have a few questions, yes.
Thank you again, May.